For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here again. It's always a pleasure to come to sit with you all and also to talk to you. There's a handout I hope everybody has, which is just sort of a kind of roadmap to what I'm going to try to talk about today. I think the topic that we put was about impermanence, permanence, and maybe there was a third thing on there, I don't remember. Temporality. Okay, which is impermanence, which will give you an idea of what I want to try to talk about. And this is about mainly about the Tiantai school of Chinese Buddhism and the way in which they think about some of these basic Buddhist ideas that I'm sure all of you are familiar with in one form or another, from one or another angle, from within one or another school, in particular the basic teaching about impermanence. And obviously that idea of impermanence is closely related to the idea of time, so temporality being just a fancy word for that. But one of the things that people often find puzzling when looking at particularly some of the Mahayana schools as they develop in China, later in Japan and in Korea, is that they also teach some kind of impermanence. And this is looked at either as a contradiction of the, or even a betrayal of the original teaching of the Buddha on impermanence, or an overriding or a supersession of it in some way, something like that, alternately. And it can be very difficult to track exactly where this teaching comes from, how it relates to the basic soteriological, that is to say, salvation-related or liberation-related teaching of impermanence in basic Buddhism. And that means both in terms of Buddhist practice and Buddhist theory and also in terms of general things that interest me also, like comparative philosophical issues, a theory of time and a theory of permanence and impermanence have to be kind of carefully extracted from the system. And I say this also because any of you who've read around in Buddhist literature, particularly in English, you may find there's a lot on Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist doctrine in Tibetan schools and Indian schools, relatively little on Chinese and Japanese schools, which are treated as traditions with their own merits and their own strong points, but rarely in terms of specific and sort of well-worked-out philosophical doctrines. And I actually want to help or try to find a way to talk about why this is so with respect to the systems that are developed in Chinese Buddhist schools. Because basically, my idea here is that there's a theory of time and temporality which pertains very directly to the basic idea of impermanence, and then impermanence and permanence as not mutually exclusive. In other words, permanence not as denying impermanence, but permanence as it were, a further thinking through of permanence, embedded, never stated quite that directly or systematically, but embedded in the systems of the Tiantai school. And a kind of parallel thing with certain tweaks in another very important Chinese Buddhist school, the Huayan school. So this is why I gave you this little chart of these four steps, the Tiantai school. And this is just about, I don't want to get very technical here, but this is to help sort of track the steps, because we'll have to return back to them one by one. This is a phenomenon known in Chinese Buddhism as classification of teachings, which may look like a very sort of a dry taxonomical enterprise. In other words, a way of classifying different teachings of the Buddha. And indeed, it has a historical background, because a lot of sutras, a lot of Buddhist literature was coming into China from India. All of it was purported to be the teaching of the historical Buddha. And as all of you probably know if you've read around in Buddhist literature, it can be wildly contradictory. All kinds of different teachings that are coming in. They're all coming in at once, more or less, and they all are authoritative. So the Chinese Buddhists had this kind of challenge on their hands. How do we organize this? And they usually did it not by rejecting any of them as false or spurious, but by putting them in a certain order. And of course, you know, there's this Buddhist idea of upaya, skillful means, which meant they could look at some of the teachings as partial truths or temporary skillful means used for pedagogy at a particular time and place, which were meant to kind of set up a further revelation of the truth in other scriptures. And so they were able to organize these kind of large, harmonious systems that included all these seemingly contradictory teachings. And that's exactly how they look at the teachings of impermanence on the one hand and permanence on the other. But the important thing to realize that about this is the way the Chinese Buddhists, I would say both in Tiantian and Huayan, think about this is not as if the Buddha taught one thing and then taught something different at another time which contradicted it, but rather that as we go through each step of what they regarded as more and more profound or complete teachings, the original teaching is preserved. The original teaching is, as it were, intensified by looking more deeply at that original teaching, seeing the implications of it in greater detail, and thinking it through further, as it were. Which means that although if you look at this chart from 1 to 4, you'll see that it moves from impermanence to permanence. That is not to be construed as saying, which appear, of course, in different sutras, right? We have, say, in the Nirvana Sutra, the teaching of permanence, at least of the Buddha nature. We can talk about other sutra sources of this. Early Buddhism is all about impermanence, which we'll talk about. But they're both true. And not only are they both true, the idea here is going to be that if we come to understand the teaching of impermanence more profoundly, impermanence itself is the permanence that is relevant to Buddhist practice. How can this be, right? This seems obviously wildly self-contradictory, and that's what the system is for, to walk us through step-by-step ways of understanding that. And I will also try to come up with some ways, intuitive things that we experience every day that may help us get a sense of what they were getting at when they talked about the non-duality of permanence and impermanence, if I can put it that way. Okay? So we will have a total rethink of the entire system of Buddhism here within Tiantai in these four steps. This is the way they classified the teachings. And they basically did it into these four types of teaching. The Tripitaka teaching, by which they meant what we would now call Theravada Buddhism and other schools like that. They sometimes use this non-PC term Hinayana for that. But the Nikayas and the Pali canon and the Agamas in the Chinese canon. And this teaching, if anyone is familiar with, we also call it basic Buddhism now sometimes, right? The teaching of impermanence, of non-self, of suffering, of all conditioned dharmas, non-self of all dharmas. The Four Noble Truths, a real-time notion of samsara and nirvana, which is to say the cycle of birth and death, understood both in terms of momentary birth and rebirth within a given lifetime and then between lifetimes, always sort of absolute flux developed in Abhidharma literature, in the notion of momentariness, so that what is ultimately real are these flashing momentary events, at least in some versions of that. Impermanence being the pan-Buddhist bedrock, right, of all Buddhist teaching in any school, right? Even as I'm trying to get at today, even those schools that are going to claim some very radical sense of permanence. So if you look at the way this is characterized here, they call this in Chinese, it would be the Sheng Mie Si Di, which means the arising and perishing Four Noble Truths. So what they do is they say the Four Noble Truths are Buddhism, but the Four Noble Truths are going to be understood in four different ways, and each of these is a further expansion of our initial understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Everybody knows the Four Noble Truths, I assume. So that's suffering and the arising of suffering, causes of arising of suffering in craving or attachment, the ending of suffering, Nibbana Nirvana, and the path leading to the end of suffering. Those stack up as suffering and its cause and the end of suffering and its cause, right? the path being the cause to the end of suffering. When they call this the arising and perishing Four Noble Truths, they mean that the contents of the Four Noble Truths, so all of samsara, everything that happens, every event in everyone's life, and then the nirvana event, which puts an end to that, are both construed in terms of, or in the modality of, arising and perishing. That is, a global picture of impermanence. That means both that this event happens now and not at another time. It begins and ends at a particular time. It's impermanent. But it also means samsara, for any sentient being, arises and perishes, which is another way of saying there's a certain moment when my samsara, if I become an arhat, okay, if I achieve nirvana, ends. It ends in real time. That means nirvana is a dharma that arises in a certain sense, right? Enlightenment arises because some points in time I'm not enlightened, I'm suffering, and other points in time I'm not suffering, I'm in nirvana, or I'm an arhat. So that would be what we call ordinary real-time notion, right? But right away, you notice that the very focus on impermanence that we have in Buddhism introduces a funny kind of a paradox there. And one way I want us to look at these four steps is as I'm working through a particular problem, which I have, I think, earlier at this talking here, have referred to as the nirvana paradox. The nirvana paradox is just that nirvana is supposed to be unconditioned, right? And in fact, the basic premise in Buddhism is that suffering and impermanence are functions of multiple causality and the failure of any one cause to control its result. That's suffering, and it's also non-self, not one cause, not one effect. We can talk about that more. And that the only real way to end that suffering would be through the end of conditionality, which would be nirvana. But the funny thing about that is that anything unconditional cannot begin at any particular time, cannot begin at any particular place. Because to begin at a particular time is to arise and perish, which is to be conditional, right? So there's a kind of paradox built into the very structure of early Buddhism, and they address it in the Pali Canon and in other early sources with a kind of what we call apophatic attitude, right? They will say, you can't really say anything about nirvana. Yes, it's paradoxical, or they'll talk about the parable of the arrow, for example, which will say, these are questions that are not edifying or not useful. Just leave it at that and stick to the practice. But it leaves this paradox intact. And again, in Tiantai, they're not negating this. In fact, they're saying this thing, even with its paradox stuck in there, this basic tension, is crucial to everything that comes later and is never refuted. It's just built upon and it's just expanded, if you like, okay? But if we're thinking in terms of arising and perishing, then the perishing of arising and perishing doesn't solve the problem. It's another conditional thing. So what happens in the Mahayana, which is what we step into in number two here, is a way of addressing this paradox of nirvana, among other things. A lot's going on in the Mahayana, of course, but in this context, this is what's focused on. And you can see that the Four Noble Truths are thought of in a different way here. Oh, I should say about the other pieces in the first one. I'm sorry, I'll go back. So arising and perishing Four Noble Truths. That means nirvana arising and perishing too, in that it's a real event that happens and puts an end to something. They use a phrase, sheng sheng, the born births the born, so impermanent things give rise to impermanent things, process constantly. And this is understood in terms of non-self and impermanence in terms of what they call analytic emptiness, which is on the one hand Dharma analysis, where you divide things into their parts and show that there's no substantial being there, so my organs and my cells, for example, right? No self in that sense. And also, that word analysis also means dissolution, dividing it out. So something dies and it scatters, right? And then it is no longer there. It's a real-time event of arising and perishing. We move into the shared teaching. This is the general Mahayana teaching. And you may be familiar with this from some presentations of Nagarjuna or Madhyamaka philosophy and the teaching of emptiness. And the teaching of emptiness makes a claim that, well, if all things are conditional, which is to say all things are relational, really, and if we were to say, for example, that really there's no substance there, there's only the relations, right? Or if we were to say things depend entirely on their relations, what we end up is that there are no things related to each other. There's no actual thing that arises. There is no entity. Obviously, there's no self when I divide it. So in a certain sense, I could say, even if you don't divide me, even if I don't dissolve, if I'm not dissolved either conceptually or really, there is no entity that actually arises that matches the name brook or table or room or and so on, right? And that would go also for suffering and samsara itself. They never really arise, and for that reason, they never really perish. And sometimes the Mahayana sutras like to go really nuts on this and say, you know, all the things are already nirvanic, which, as you can see, is a way of addressing that paradox of nirvana, right? Which is to say, it can't be that nirvana is a special condition that will only happen at certain times and places to certain people. It's now seen as what it should be if it's unconditional, which is absolutely omnipresent and going on at all times, no matter what entities are there. All entities never arise, never perish. They're already extinct. They're already extinguished. Pure emptiness in that sense, right? So nothing, this is called the unborn Four Noble Truths. So that means suffering and the arising of suffering, causes of suffering, and the ending of suffering, and the path, right, all Buddhist practice, are not to be conceived as real entities since they are composed entirely of their parts and their relations and their conditions. So that seen truly, they are already nirvanic. They are already liberated. Sometimes we have Buddha nature spoken of in this way too, right? They're unborn, they're unperishing. And this is called embodied emptiness, and to try to translate the Chinese, but just as they are in their essence, they are already empty. Or sheng bu sheng, the born is in reality unborn. What we call the born, the arising and perishing, never arises and perishes. So the emphasis on arising and perishing itself, in other words, that only relations and only processes exist, now leads to the flip-flop to say, precisely because there are no things that are in process, no things proceeding, if you like, no things related, there is no process. There can't be a process without the things. There cannot be relations without the things related, right? So because there's only relations, it turns out there are no things, and if there are no things, there are no relations. There are no processes. Okay? However, that's a nice way to solve the nirvana paradox, theoretically, but you may notice that it also leaves, you might say, just pushes the problem back one step. Because now what we have is a division between, you might say, appearance and reality. Now I'm really saying, in reality, if you see it truly, all things are already nirvanic or already Buddha nature, already unborn, already unceasing. But we see them as arising and perishing. And so now our problem is this kind of pragmatic, soteriological, practical one of trying to see how things always already are nirvanic, which they would have to be because it's the unconditioned. But now the seeing of it becomes highly conditional in just the same way that the attaining of it was before. It happens at a particular time and place, only to certain people. You're either deluded about it or you're enlightened, and so on. Right? So you have another kind of embedding of the conditionality that haunted the first level there, just at a higher level, you might say. This is where you get things like the two truths doctrine, which some of you may have studied, right? So that's in conventional truth, things arise and perish. In conventional truth, we practice the path, we attain nirvana, right? Definable reality, and there's actual real time going on there. But what that leads to, if we successfully practice that illusory path, is to see that the path was illusory. Right, is to see that you were always enlightened from the beginning, right? Which is to say, to see ultimate truth. Having pushed that back, there's another step in the Tiantai picture, and they call this the separate or the special teaching, BHL. Now, this is originally conceived of, I can also link this to specific sutras, which they will link it to. So often they will say things like the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Huayan Sutra, Kegonkyo, is a sutra preached only for bodhisattvas. Certain other sutras in the Mahayana canon they will look at as that way, as having these very advanced teachings. But the way they read them in Tiantai is that there's this special class of beings who, seeing this situation and this continued split between appearance and reality for all other sentient beings, right, where you're in nirvana all the time, but you don't realize it. And this gives rise to this sense of compassion and infinite responsibility for these other beings. But it also comes with a certain new set of insights and a certain new set of practices, right, as you are probably all familiar with. So the shared teaching of the Mahayana is that basic thing for all sentient beings in the Mahayana, and the special teachings for these kind of heroic figures, the bodhisattvas. Now, this one is a little tricky, and this is where things, I think, get really interesting, because you'll notice the next characterization of the Four Noble Truths, the infinite Four Noble Truths. That's in number three here, right? And as it's written on the thing here, suffering, delusion, nirvana, and path are each infinite. Wu liang is the term in Chinese. It means innumerable, or maybe to gloss it a little, of innumerable variety. And this means that the types of suffering, the types of arising of suffering, are infinite in variety as sentient beings are. And this is something that you well know bodhisattvas are very concerned about, right? Because bodhisattvas have taken a vow to save all sentient beings, innumerable, the same term, innumerable sentient beings, and all these sentient beings are different and attached in different ways and deluded in different ways. So they all have their own very specific types of suffering and their own very specific ways of craving and attachment that lead to their specific sufferings. But that now also means they're going to have their own specific kinds of nirvanas, cessations of it, and their own very specific kinds of paths. And this is what the bodhisattvas, because they have taken reinvested in the world in a certain way. The world is kind of reaffirmed at the second step in the sense that, well, you don't have to destroy the samsaric world to reach nirvana, because in a certain sense it already is nirvana, right? But the bodhisattvas go a step further, stay in the conventional side of the world to be voluntarily reborn. They take a vow, and their vow involves this engagement with infinite sentient beings. And that now means infinite Four Noble Truths. Now, this is concomitant with a further refinement of the notion of emptiness. We already saw impermanence, non-self, thought through a little more pervasively gives us emptiness in this global sense in step two, right? Not a refutation of it, although it sounds like one, because first we said everything's impermanent, and then we said nothing is impermanent. But in the first two steps already, nothing is impermanent was just thinking through more thoroughly that everything is impermanent, right? Because if everything is only relations, there are no relations, right? Same idea. But here, we're going to go another step further, right? And we're going to say, let's think through this emptiness thing even further to help redress this continued, not quite dualism between the two truths, because they're not a dualism. They stand in a very intimate relationship, even at level two. But still, division between them. And so now, if you look at the bottom of this, we don't speak of emptiness anymore. We speak of the middle. The middle way. Now, everyone knows the middle way is a hoary old Buddhist term. Buddhism is the middle way, right? Originally between annihilationism and eternalism, or between indulgence in desires and suppression of desires and so on, right? In the second level, it's between being and non-being, or sameness and difference, or permanence and change already, because everything is unborn, it has no characteristics that can be assigned to it. That's a kind of neither nor middle way. But now the middle way is identified with this other idea, the Buddha nature, and it pertains to the relation between the two truths. In other words, between the ultimate truth of emptiness, where everything's unborn, and the conventional delusions about emptiness of sentient beings, which see things born in these infinite number of ways and attach to them in infinite number of ways. The middle is the middle between those two. And again, in Tiantai, they will say, that's not different from the teaching of emptiness. That's the emptiness of emptiness. And the emptiness of emptiness has to be understood in to mean not even more refined. Like sometimes emptiness of emptiness is understood to mean don't attach to the notion of emptiness. There's some, even that is too much of a definite something, right? And this is true here too, but the way they understand that is as a reversal back into the conventional. Not empty. Empty is empty means empty is also an affirmation of the conventional. You can think of this as, again, not a double negation, right? Or a more thorough emptiness. And I often use the example of the blankness of a wall as opposed to the blankness of a mirror. So the blankness of a wall is nothing, right? Is to say emptiness construed as the denial of something, of some determinate forms or of arising and perishing. But the emptiness of a mirror is even more empty. It doesn't even have whiteness that's definite to it. It doesn't exclude anything. It doesn't have, even emptiness is too definite a thing if it can exclude non-emptiness, right? So even more emptiness than emptiness is the non-emptiness. That's the sort of miracle of a negation, right? You push that negation further, it reverses itself like that. So instead of emptiness, we have the middle way. Here they call it the exclusive middle way. And that means what produces both the conventional truth, because the bodhisattvas, on the basis of seeing that all entities have no self-nature, right? That they are empty in their essence from beginning to end, also knows that this is what allows them to appear to sentient beings in all these varied ways. That it's precisely because there is this emptiness, just like the mirror, that allows it to produce this infinity of forms. But for these infinity of forms, all of which are suffering, first two noble truths, the bodhisattvas have this sort of creative engagement where they make up stuff, that's remedial stuff, upayas, skillful means, and they do this infinitely. That's part of their vow, right? And that, too, is based on the middle way, emptiness of emptiness. That allows them, it's the productivity of emptiness is what is seen in the middle of the way, or the creativity of it. On the one hand, it's the allowing of delusion, and delusion is not is an expression of it in some sense. But in another sense, the bodhisattva's responses to those deluded productions is directly done through an awareness of the middle way. Now, I sometimes compare this to the two sides of a coin. So maybe this will be helpful. If you had a coin which was printed with a picture, let's say, of a bird or something on one side and blank on the other, right? You might say two truths is originally kind of like this. You have the world with all its particular things, and we know all of those are delusions, right? Because nothing really arises, so nothing with self-nature arises. And then behind it, you see the blank, which is the negation of all those particular forms, that none of them have arisen, right? They are actually not what they appear to be. They are not the self-natured entities they seem to be. That's the two truths. But the third level would say, actually, both of those two sides are one-sided. The blank side is just as one-sided as the printed side. And both of those express the stuff in the middle, right? The coin in the middle, the metal of the coin, can either express as unmarked or as marked, but even unmarked is a kind of marking. It's different from the marked, right? And the real middle is not the blankness. We don't privilege emptiness over provisional conventional reality anymore. Both of those two are expressions of the mean. And on the conventional side, we have both delusion, the creativity of the middle or of emptiness in delusion, and the creativity of it taken up through the deliberate compassionate action of the bodhisattvas. So there you have the innumerable or infinite Four Noble Truths. And it's interesting the characterization in the third scheme, the unborn, bushangshang in Chinese, the unborn gives rise. So the unborn, that is to say emptiness, right, which we read, and note that we presume that we still keep the result of number two. We're not throwing it away with a whole new teaching. We're saying we've gone from birth to non-birth, and now the creativity of that non-birth, right, in this new sense. We're keeping all the steps along the way. All right, so the unproduced produces here, both through its indeterminability, right? It's this ontological ambiguity, I sometimes say, the mirror-like quality of something with no self-nature, which means it doesn't have a blank self-nature, right, either, because that would be a definite thing. So the infinity of any particular thing like that, but though that is based in the emptiness of things, it's also the suffering and delusions of sentient beings, we also have the bodhisattva deliberate response to ameliorate it. Okay? Also rooted in their knowledge that to posit something conventionally and to see its emptiness are two sides of the same coin. They're not really two different things. Okay? And from there we move to probably the trickiest step, which in Tiantai is considered the culmination of all this, and this is where we get from impermanence to permanence. Now I should say that there's already a kind of permanence, right, in steps 2 and 3. But it's, you could say, when we say unborn, we mean unperishing, and it's almost a pun, you know, it's almost a joke. Emptiness is impermanent, is permanent, right? Just like nirvana is permanent, right? But it's in contrast to the impermanent. Now, in step 1, that's a real contrast, right? In step 2, it's an epistemological, it's in terms of what we know, right? We see it either as permanent or impermanent. But there still is a permanent thing, which is emptiness there, or nirvana, which is the nature of all things. In step 3, it's the middle way, right, which is the permanent, which is permanent while the both emptiness in the first sense and provisional positing are impermanent. Right? But in the third step, something new happens. And to get at this, I would like you to look at the characterizations here. So we had arising and perishing Four Noble Truths, 1. Unborn Four Noble Truths, 2. Immeasurable Four Noble Truths, 3. And now we get something called the unmade Four Noble Truths. Okay? 无作四谛. Now, this is kind of weird and surprising even in Chinese, because the terms used here, 无作, you might think is very similar to 无生. That is to say, unmade and unborn, what's the difference? Right? And the difference is only discernible if we remember that this is building upon level 3. That is the difference, that just as level 3 includes level 2, and level 2 includes level 1 and just pushes it further, level 4 is saying all that creative production of delusions and enlightened upayas of the middle way and number 3, which are made by sentient beings, right? Made. The word made, I think I say on here, has two implications. One is, it begins at a particular point in time, that's just like born, but it also has the implication of a deliberate deed by an agent. And all this creativity we had on the third level was by either deluded sentient beings who create determinations through their attachments, right, and through their misconceptions, or the vow-conditioned upayas, skillful means created by bodhisattvas. These are done by certain beings at certain times, and that's why that's called the separate. It's a special teaching, but it's also separate. Separate in several senses, the third one. One is that the deluded creations and the enlightened responses are done by different agents. They have different doers, illusory doers, or middle way doers. And that certain beings only, if it goes as part of the same idea, are bodhisattvas, and all the other beings are not bodhisattvas. But at the fourth level, they feel this is really just an even higher level of the original nirvana paradox, another dualism, if you like, right, between the savior bodhisattvas and the saved deluded beings, for example, right, or between the deluded samsaric illusions and the enlightened upayic responses. And the whole thrust in Tiantai is to break that last dualism. And to do that, they introduce this idea of the unmade Four Noble Truths, which means those agential deeds of both deluded beings and bodhisattvas never begin and are never the deeds of any one particular agent. They cannot be constrained either to one agent as opposed to other agents, or even to what we regard as agents, sentient beings, as opposed to insentient beings. This is where we get the, maybe to some of you familiar, Chinese Buddhist teaching of the interpervasion of all things. Okay? Indra's net type stuff, right? Where everything that's going on anywhere is in some sense going on everywhere. They call this the non-exclusive mean or the interfusing three truths. And that, this gets rather technical, but I'll try to be short about this because on the technical side of it. So the technical side of it is to say, look, instead of the middle was a way of saying, let's not privilege emptiness over the conventional. And this interfusion of three truths is a way of saying, let's not privilege the middle over the two extremes of emptiness and the conventional. What does that mean? It means that now we can see any positing of a conventional thing as both a middle way that pervades, is eternal, is unconditioned, is omnipresent and omnitemporal, and which is the negation of both itself and all things. Any one of the three truths does the work of all the three truths. That's what they mean by interfused. Simply by thinking that through. The technical logical details are very interesting and sort of fun to play with, but I maybe we'll cut that a little bit short and try to give you an intuitive way to understand this because I want to compare this to the Huayan case. So one of the upshots of this is they want to affirm, famously in Tiantai, that all conventional truths are eternal. All conventional entities, not just their essence, not just their the emptiness that is their real nature or is their non-nature, not just the middle way that manifests either at like the mirror, the reflectivity of the mirror and its ability to show all those things, but all those things. All of that's eternal. And all of that, if we follow this progression, is also impermanent. How do we do this? Because you could say, even the middle way, that was permanent, but as impermanent. That's why it had those two sides, right? It was precisely the non-duality of permanence and impermanence, of the permanence of emptiness, right, of no characteristics, and the impermanence of every arising and perishing conventional experience. Well, now that very same non-dual quality pertains not just to the middle, but to the very idea of negating emptiness, okay, or to positing, which is to say conventional. And one way to understand this, I always think, is to think how are we going to understand how you can mean that something is impermanent because it's permanent and permanent because it's impermanent. And I will try out an example for you. And the kind of examples I like to use, and I'm not sure this works, so this will be, I'd like to open this to discussion, but an interesting way to think about this, let's say, is to think about the notion of a style or a mode or even a mood. Because we know how, in a very intuitive, everyday way, something can be two things at once. Let's start with a mood, right? So I think it's intelligible for me to say he was cheerfully angry or he was angrily cheerful, right? These are seemingly opposed qualities, but I think you could determine, you could imagine in a work of fiction or in a description of a friend what that might mean, right? There's an adverb there, and then there's a verb, right? Or you could say he was aggressively sad, right? Or he was passively imposing or something like that, right? There's all kinds of ways, we usually think of that in terms of a how and a what, right? A mode or a mood, or you could say even a mood, like an emotional mood, right? Like I was drearily, you know, enjoying my favorite show or something like that, or I was excitedly bored. I think this is a Who song I'm thinking of now. But anyway, give you some sense in which there's a need for that even in our language. And I often think a style is an even more profound example of this, which is to say, you can think of the same story with the same events filmed, let's talk about a film, in a completely different style, right? If you think of very characteristic styles, I don't know, I always think of Hitchcock, right? You could think of, you know, the story of the Kennedy assassination in Hitchcockian style. And that would mean every element in there smells a little Hitchcocky, right? Tastes a little Hitchcocky. There's Hitchcockness there. It's not a specific one place and time entity. It's pervading in the entire structure of the thing, and yet there's the grassy knoll. I hope this example is still pertinent to people. Or I could think of, you know, Kurosawa version of the JFK assassination, or a Coen Brothers version, right? And in each of those cases, all the same objects would be there, but they'd be there in a different style, right? So I would have, and this is what, something like this is what we mean in Tiantai when they say weird things like the Buddha realm includes the devil realm and the devil realm includes the Buddha realm, which is to say that every single element of experience is both a style and a content and for each other. I mean, that would be the next step of this, which gets really interesting, which means I could film Kurosawa's life in Hitchcockian style, and I could film Hitchcock's life in Kurosawa's style, right? And all those elements, even him making his movies, right? You ever see those Van Gogh paintings of the Japanese Edo prints, right? There's a good example of it. They're very Van Gogh, but all the content of those Japanese prints is in there, right? And you can imagine the reverse. Or you can imagine the way in which a Van Gogh painting of a sunflower and a Monet painting of the same sunflower and Manet painting, it's the same but different. And you could say there's even a sameness of difference between the content and the style in each case, right? So you can have the Buddha in the devil realm, the Buddha devilishly, being a Buddha, or the devil Buddha-ishly being a devil, and the same for all sentient beings and all particular experiences, which are now looked at, any impermanent event is now looked at as a style. That's what I'm trying to get at here. A style of being. And you know, a style of being has no one particular content. That's where the emptiness amounts to here, okay? It could be anything in there. They're all composed of a bunch of other things which are organized now into a particular style. They read out with a certain flavor. But you notice there's something funny about a style. If you go to a Hitchcock movie and you get into it and it works as a Hitchcock movie and you're immersed in it and you walk out into the lobby, you start to see the world as kind of a Hitchcock movie, right? It's infinitely extendable precisely because it's not limited to any one finite set of contents. Any content can be Hitchcockian or Coen Brothers-y or Kurosawan, right? And once you've caught it, once you've perceived it, it extends infinitely and interestingly not just to the future, but you can now think of any event in the past precisely, you can, as a historical drama, in precisely that way. So what happens in Tiantai in the fourth teaching is something like this. The arising of any event is as a sort of a disclosure of a style of being which, once it occurs, has always existed, if I can put it that way, right? Just like grokking a particular style is to see that it's applicable infinitely to an infinite number of contents. And with that, the flip-flop moment, which is any one of those contents, can also be a style, which, once seen as a style, is also seen to be necessarily also discoverable in any and any contents, both before and after. And you see what we have here is the perfect meshing of permanence and impermanence. What is a moment of time? A moment of time, what is an experience of a sentient being? It is the disclosure of a kind of style of being that, even if it's never occurred before, once it has occurred, it has always occurred. Right? But it's still completely empty, because whatever it is can also always be rewritten in every other style. And every style is full of contents, each of which is another potential style. Right? So we get here to the non-exclusive mean. And I want to, again, reiterate, this is crucial for Tiantai. It's not simply a philosophical reflection, because you've got to, the way this is set up, it's always about the Four Noble Truths, which means it's always about suffering. And it's always about suffering as a function of conditionality. So solving the conditionality problem is solving the suffering problem. And yet, we see that if permanence and impermanence converge in this way, that means suffering and the ending of suffering converge in this way. And that's precisely what we get in Tiantai, has a very famous and controversial doctrine of the inherent ineradicable evil of the Buddha nature. That's the 10 realms interpenetrate, and even in Buddhahood, the evil nature or the nature of demonhood and suffering, all the 9 other realms of samsara are always present. just like all those contents would be in any of those styles. Okay? But that means that what practice amounts to is the experiencing of any conditional content as also unconditional, as all pervasive, and that means even the evil content. And this always sounds shocking, maybe not only to Buddhists, but especially to Buddhists, right? Because it means the ending of suffering is the all pervasion or omnipresence of suffering, right? It means to see suffering as unconditional and ineradicable is the only way to end suffering. Now, if that sounds counterintuitive to you, two little cheats that I hope will make it a little more intuitive, both on the basis of what we've got through so far and in general. First of all, the all-pervasive, this is a very common Tiantai move, where anything which applies universally loses, because conditional things are what they are because of their contrast to what they are not, right? Because they exclude something, right? So red is only red because there's not red in the world, right? And if everything were red, that wouldn't be red anymore. And yet it would be more red than any red we have now, right? If I were to say everything in the universe is white, or I just say everything in the universe is black, those are not the same as the black and white, which are relative to each other, right? And this flip comes from the way in Tiantai they consider conditionality as such. That's one point. So on the one hand, you can describe that universal, ineradicable, unconditional evil as more present, okay, as even more present, but precisely by being unescapable, absolutely unescapable, its nature, you might say, its style, flips into the Buddhist style. And it's interesting to me, which is to say the unconditional style. It is seen as unconditional, which means it is seen as a style, which means that anything can be expressed as redness, or redness can express anything, or suffering can express anything. If that sounds weird, I would want to return to a very old Buddhist story that some of you may know. How many of you know? I think it's in the Pali Canon, I believe, the story of the mustard seed. The story of the mustard seed, you know, seems like a very straightforward level one kind of story about impermanence and death, right? So if you don't remember that story, it's a woman has a child who dies, and she goes around asking if someone can restore her infant child to life. And somebody says, well, there's that guy, Shakyamuni, who's supposed to be good at this kind of thing. And she goes over to him, and he says, yeah, simple. I have a recipe that will cure that instantly for you. I'll make it right now. Oh, wait, there's just one thing I need for an ingredient. I need just a very tiny thing, a mustard seed, right? And she says, oh, sure, I'll get one right now. But the thing is, it has to be a mustard seed from a household where no one has tasted death. So, of course, she goes around door to door asking everyone, can you borrow one little mustard seed from me? And they all say, sure. And then one little extra question, has anyone in your family or anyone you know died? And, of course, everyone says yes. And she goes for, you know, however you want to tell this story, months, years, however long it takes, until suddenly it dawns on her, there is no place where death can be escaped. The unconditionality, if you like, of death. And that's the moment the nature of that experience flips, right? Even in a very straightforward Hinayana, quote-unquote, way, right, where her attachment to it or to her own grief, the quality of it changes once she sees it no longer as just something located in this one time and place applying only to me. The negation or the transcending of the suffering of death and the recognition of the inescapability of the suffering of death are one and the same in that story. And you could see something like that logic, if you like, writ large in the Tiantai doctrine of inherent ineradicable evil as Buddhahood. Okay, so very deep, straightforward Buddhist roots there. The last thing I want to say, because I think I'm running out of time, is just to compare this to what I think might be a slightly more familiar rubric from Chinese Buddhism. And it's an interesting comparison, I think, because on the one hand, the Huayan school develops a little later than the Tiantai school. And I think it would be fair to say that one of the things they're doing is simplifying, but also adding detail and, in some cases, some rigor and some user-friendliness to some Tiantai ideas, which, as you can see from here, are not always easy to, like, dig out of their lobster shell, you know. And so this is a really powerful one, this fourfold Dharma Dhatus, right? It's very easy to grasp at least the structure of it, right? Even if the idea still seems weird, and you're probably familiar with this. So it's so-called shurfajia, world of events. And it's important to know that shur is a word for a temporal event, but you know it's not really emphasized there, but an impermanent event. It's not u, which would be a thing, an inert thing, but shur, which is an event. The world of principle, which in Huayan context means emptiness, right? And so I put temporal, atemporal, because you can see that these are, in a way, nice shorthand ways of saying the first two steps in the Tiantai school, right? The world of events is a real-time world of one thing coming after another, and the world of principle would be seeing all of that as actually principle or emptiness, right? And you might even say three. It could be somebody's way of summarizing the third step, right? Because here we have the Buddha nature or emptiness and events, that creative motion, a notion where the two are no longer separate, right? We call it the middle way in Tiantai. Here they call it the non-obstruction of emptiness and of atemporal and temporal, or if you like, or of emptiness and conventional, right? The non-obstruction of principle and events. But note, first thing to note, that infinity notion, it's not that it's not there, but it's that it has now been pushed back a little in terms of the emphasis, all right? And the notion of the sort of productivity, the sheng notion there, and its paradoxical nature relation to the previous step is reconfigured slightly here, okay, in a slightly different language. But I think they're intending the same thing. And finally, the fourth one, you could say, this is the famous world of the non-obstruction of event with event. Emptiness drops out, and now we're talking about Indra's net stuff, right? Every event, like we were talking about a moment ago, interpenetrating, intersubsuming with other events. And again, I do think this is an attempt to give a short rubric of this, and then in Huayan they will develop lots of detailed approaches to that concept, to that idea. The temporal idea, or the way in which temporality and atemporality now pertain still at the fourth level, maybe is a little obscured in this formulation, where it's not obscured in like Fazang or other theorists' development of it, because they will apply this to time, okay? They will say, you know, any moment in time includes all other moments in time, let's say, or is non-obstructed with other moments in time. But the atemporal aspect of a moment in time, the formulation kind of dims that a little bit. It dims the agency and then the overriding of agency in the Tiantai version. And above all, I think, and of course, you know, the idea of inherent evil is really just this idea of number four, right? Which is to say, look, if all things interpenetrate, then suffering and nirvana interpenetrate, and demonhood and Buddhahood have to interpenetrate, okay? And delusion and enlightenment have to interpenetrate. The Tiantai critiques of Huayan always say they're just looking at enlightenment now, and they're saying in enlightenment everything interpenetrates. And so suddenly the delusion side, which was the whole point of it in number four in Tiantai, drops out, though it is an attempted restatement of the same thing. I won't get into the inter-Nicene polemics here, but just so you're alert to how I think a good faith attempt to reformulate the same idea slightly changes the meaning, but in a very decisive way. And another thing about it is that the four Dharma Dhatus, as I said, these seem to be four alternate ways of looking at the world. Right? Just straight up. You look at it this way, or you look at it this way, or you look at it this way, or you look at it, best of all, this fourth way. But it's not clear that the fourth way is just another way of stating the first way, which is the case in the Tiantai system, right? Where they have a special word for this, where the original view of impermanence simply seen more thoroughly. In other words, in this sort of style vision, you don't have any extra thing that's not impermanent there. It's that even the framework of a thing is impermanent, right? Even the parameters, the laws of nature that apply, or the laws of relations between things, that style that overrides the particulars, that too is impermanent. That's the source of their permanence. That is the very locus of their permanence. So I think, am I about at the time when I should finish?
Yeah.
All right, let's do that. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So responses, questions, comments? Yes, Jan.
This makes me think about something that I don't understand in mathematics.
Oh.
And that is the different kinds of instinct. So if you take the natural numbers.
Yeah. Yes.
It's something that I didn't study enough to even know if I'm talking about two or three different times.
Yes. No, I wouldn't claim to understand that either in the mathematical realm, right? So I know that, but I share your sense that this is relevant, very relevant to what we're talking about today. I mean, sometimes students bring this up. I'm not equipped with the mathematical skill to really track it down, the higher mathematics stuff, but definitely this. A finite infinity, let's say, right? Or the kind of way in which finitude and infinity are not mutually exclusive. Finitude and infinity are not mutually exclusive, right? Because finitude and conditionality can sort of be equivalent, right? So you have a finite space between two numbers, which is infinite, and yet there's also, you know, is it the same or is it different? Buddhists would want to say, whenever you ask that question, probably neither same nor different. Right? But or both same and different, right. And that's exactly what we're getting at here, right? An infinite series in a style, as I'm trying to put it there, right? It's not either finite or infinite. It's not either definite or indefinite, right? It's somehow both. Maybe there's a way to intuit that liberatively through mathematics, and maybe some other ways too. Yeah.
Yes. Maybe this is another piece of passing that different understanding of, but it seems to me that styles, as you say, can be applied to an infinite number of objects of Dharma, but they have to have a Dharma to apply to.
Yes.
Have a Hitchcockian retelling of nothing.
Exactly.
It has to be a telling of something.
Yes.
So you need the Dharma to apply.
Yes.
The style of conditionality or unconditionality.
Yes.
So what is the Dharma? Is that right?
Excellent.
Is the,
I know what
also
you're...
the style.
Yeah. That, so where do all the contents come from? Is
yes.
sort of your question.
Yeah. I mean,
right.
Connecting.
And this is super interesting, and I think it's another thing that sort of breaks between the Tiantai and the Huayan, right? Because you know, that could be construed as saying, like, well, there's got to be something there that's being stylized, right?
Yes.
Like that. What's there in Tiantai? I will tell you. Delusion. This. And so where does it come from? Yes, delusion. So what does Dogen say? It's delusion. It is. So it's a delusion about all the other delusions, or about enlightenment. They're just delusions of each other. But what's the starting point? The starting point is experience, which is deluded. So where does the Dharma of paper come from? My deluded attachment to what? What will it be outside of that? I guess you could give a kind of foundationalist version of the answer in Tiantai. They'd say the 3,000 realms. So in other words, it's not that it's ultimately atoms, and it's not that it's ultimately Brahman, or it's not that it's ultimately matter, it's not that it's ultimately mind, okay? It's ultimately the 3,000. Buddhahood, demonhood, the 10 suchnesses, okay, the such, rusha xiang, rusha xing, etc., which is to say the such-like appearances experience, every possible way of experiencing, re-experiencing, re-stylizing any experience. So there's no starting point, right, in Buddhism, right? It's not an origin story that something like then gets messed up along the way. It's always been samsara. It's always been delusion. It's always been conditionality. And that means there's always been experiences that were always one-sided, but they don't land finally in any one place. You know, this goes back to the very notion of what an illusion is already in step two, right? When we say, you know, those Mahayana sutras like to say, you know, the five skandhas are like illusions or are illusions, all the way up to Buddhahood is an illusion, and Nirvana is an illusion, and even if something were beyond Nirvana, that too would be an illusion, right? And what happens there is where Tantai draws that point I was making before, where they say, well, if you say everything without exception is an illusion, then the meaning of illusion changes. And they can then flip that over and say, everything is illusory and everything is real. Because realness just means the exact same thing as illusoriness. Because what does illusoriness mean if you don't exempt at least one thing from it? You know, normally we say, it looks like this, but we boil it down, and finally there's something that can't be boiled down anymore, right? And that's its essential nature. You know, I think it's a dinosaur on the screen, but really it's lights and flickering images. That's what it is, right? But if lights if I can go further, I keep going further. But the point is, if there's not any one starting point or one foundational point, then all that really means is I can view lights and flickering images as dinosaur, or I can view dinosaur as lights and flickering images. And to be real is to be viewable in more than one way. Right? Is to have a back. You know, in an easy phenomenological sense, why is this a real physical object? Because I can't see all of it. Right? If I could see all of it, it would be illusory. But if it's real, it means I can't see all of it, which means it's seeable from different angles, and there's more to see about it. Right? So the same way, to be illusory and to actually be real, that means empty, and to be involved in causal and conditional relations are the same thing. Right? So what is it? Yes, you could say it's emptiness, if by emptiness you mean dependent co-arising. But dependent co-arising also means demonhood. So what is this made of? In Tantai, they will say, this is made of hell, or this is made of Buddhahood. But it's made of the interpervasion of Buddhahood in hell, too, etc., etc. Their word for that is 3,000. You know? So it's a way of having anything chosen at random will function as the source of all being, as what everything else is really about. You know, that's another Indra's net meaning, right? It means that when you're looking for a foundation and an ultimate ground, sure, say emptiness, or say Tathagatagarbha, or say Buddha nature, or say God. But really, or matter, right? But really, that's an upaya. And that sets up that structure of reduction. But that structure of reduction is the real point. And that goes for any dharma, because as soon as you think through whatever you're reducing to, as I said, that thing ceases to be what it was originally named.
Each thing is the source, but it's empty.
Exactly. Each thing is the source, but it's empty, right? Which means it's the gateway to any other thing being equally a name for that source.
So it's just like recursive or fractal relationships, kind of. Like,
yeah.
It's the recursion of things related to things that create the things that relate.
Yes, but again, there, you know, you have to always go one more meta step and say, or you can just say things in absolute isolation from each other. No relations at all, right? And then they will say, you know, that's why the interfusion of the three truths will say, just positing something in its definiteness already makes it empty, already negates itself and other things, right? And therefore already connects both positing and negating. So just pencilhood or paperhood, you know, does all the work of the three truths, you know. But then you've got to get into upaya stories and, you know, really in the bodhisattva kind of picture, the epistemological consequences of the bodhisattva picture, right? Where the delusions of sentient beings are the premise by which any truth, on the grounds of which any truth claim is made, right? It's in relation to a prior delusion, right, that any definite statement is made.
Last question, Dylan. Do any schools debate or discuss the difference or similarity of change and response? Cloud can change into water.
Yeah.
If by him responding to something like there's at least in my mind, an introduction of a sense of consciousness making possible a choice to do something.
Yeah.
And that may necessarily be different or the same as change.
Yeah,
or
I think interesting that you, I mean, I think that's exactly what's going on in step three. This is how they talk about bodhisattvas, right? Bodhisattvas go through samsara, but they never initiate any action. They, in fact, they use exactly that term, respond. You know, bodhisattvas respond, so they're creative. They're creating karma, but they're not creating karma. They're creating responses. So they will call it sentient beings create karma, and bodhisattvas create responses to that karma. But the content of those might be completely the same, right? There are different modes of that creation. So the kind of, you know, and sometimes it would mean, you know, if it's too hot, I got to create a response of too cold over here, right? But the creating too cold could also be just a form of karma, right? So it's remedial relation to a prior delusion that makes it a response, and that's done through an agent, which is the bodhisattva. Now that's canceled in step four, though, right? Because agenthood per se... canceled, but we would say sublated, you know. That is to say, just like every other step here, it's just thought through more deeply what is agenthood, what is choice. It doesn't end up being possible to make it mutually exclusive with non-choice and the non-deliberate. Right? And so, and which also has some echoes in some indigenous Chinese thinking, you know, wu-wei idea, which is this non-deliberate activity. So in Tiandai, they always say, the bodhisattvas don't deliberately think I'm going to respond with the salvific, skillful means. It's in their nature, right? Because all things are in their nature. So they're just like, they don't even think about it. They don't even know they're compassionate in some way, right? So in step three, the traditional sort of Indian classical notion of a bodhisattva is very deliberate, right? I make a vow, and it's a very heroic kind of, you know, vigorous vow, right? And I know that I'm a bodhisattva. But this is what they take from the Lotus Sutra in particular, that you can be a bodhisattva without knowing it.
So on that note, why don't we close with a step three recitation, which we always do, which has hints of step four somewhere. So more bodhisattva back.